Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You could legitimately look at the markets today, stock markets, foreign exchange markets, oil and the bond markets, and ask, what the heck? Good thing we're here then, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday. This one is the 10th of March. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Caveat number one as we get going today. There is never a single cause of anything that happens in that cumbersome beast we call the markets. It is beyond complicated out there. Caveat number two and related. Oh, brother, is it going to be the sad music when we get there? As is so often the case when there is a day like this, there are plenty of places to point your finger, from the Federal Reserve to the European Central Bank to dairy farms in New Zealand. Seriously? Marketplace's Stan Alcorn went in search of the origin of today's stock market sell-off.
When there's a big move in the stock market, everyone looks for explanations, which means the phone in the office of Scott Wren, senior global equity strategist at Wells Fargo, has been ringing off the hook.
You know, when you have 15,000 brokers and the market's down, you know, 250 plus in the Dow, they tend to ring your phone a little bit.
The theories range from weakness in the oil patch to worries about Greece to, I kid you not, this is from a Bloomberg article, threatening letters sent to New Zealand dairy producers.
Now, I have not heard about that.
Wren points instead to two interrelated factors, a soaring dollar, which we'll come back to, and then expectation that the Fed will soon raise interest rates. When rates go up, that means less easy money pumping up the stock market. Stephen Englander, currency strategist at Citigroup, thinks that is at the root of the sell-off, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
It just seems that everyone is saying U.S. rates up. That's bad for me, whether I'm in France or Toronto or Australia.
But the timing is more of a mystery. Englander thinks the latest round of interest rate fears were kicked off 2 weeks ago when Fed Vice Chair Stanley Fischer told CNBC there was a high probability the Fed would raise interest rates this year.
It's about time. We've gotten used to thinking of a zero interest rate as normal. It's far from normal.
One thing that did happen overnight was a sudden spike in the value of the dollar, which could also hurt U.S. stocks by devaluing American companies' profits overseas. But what explains that?
Why this sort of realization hit the market at around 8 p.m. New York time last night or 8 a.m. Asia time is a bit of a puzzle because, I've checked with colleagues and there's no real news.
Could it be that the trigger was actually that threat to the New Zealand dairy farmers, which sparked a sell-off in the New Zealand dollar known as the kiwi?
The little kiwi that roared. I don't think so.
But he can't entirely rule it out either. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
There are plus or minus 40 or so people on this earth who are at least 112 years old. But if you happen to check the records at the Social Security Administration, you would find 6.5 million Americans listed who are at least that age and are listed as still being alive. Turns out, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains, that is one expensive mistake.
The Social Security Administration keeps track of deaths in the U.S. with a death master file. The Inspector General at Social Security decided to give it an audit after getting a call from a bank that went something like this. Hey, a young guy just opened an account with us, but his Social Security number says he was born in 1886. So,
how do you have people who were supposedly born those dates, and yet there's no death on the death master file?
That's Ronna Lawson, an audit executive in the Inspector General's office. She says, yeah, banks use the death master file. So does the E-Verify program, used to find undocumented workers. Lawson says 4,000 of those 112-year-olds were put through E-Verify.
I don't know whether those 4,000 people got the jobs or not.
At least 8 federal agencies used the death master file, agencies like Veterans Affairs and the IRS. Since the file isn't 100% accurate, they could be paying out refunds and pensions to dead people. Steve Ellis is vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense.
It's important for the Social Security Administration to get this right, because other government agencies and financial institutions rely on this data.
The Social Security Administration did respond to the audit. It says it doesn't have the money or manpower to correct the death master file, but will look into the problem and report back by the end of September. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Plunged would be a word you might use. Cratered would be another. I wouldn't go so far as crashed, but I would entertain crushed. How about this? How about Wall Street was just ugly today? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are, by a certain way of reckoning, living in the app economy. There are apps that'll let you get your grocery shopping done, get your clothes washed, get your garage cleaned out, as well as get you from point A to point B, hence the phenomenon of everything trying to be the Uber of everything. The operating principle here is that smartphones connect people who want a job done with those who need the work. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, there are some ups and downs in the Uberized economy.
3 years ago, A.J. Brustein was a brand manager for Coca-Cola. At the time, he noticed one problem that Coke's merchandisers, the companies who keep Coke stocked on store shelves, constantly struggled with.
Almost every single time, they would get a phone call from, let's say, a store manager of a Walmart. And that store manager would say, hey, you just sold out of Coke Zero. We need you to come in right now and restock the shelves.
Unplanned stops meant delays and diverting staff from other jobs, which all added up to lost sales and increased costs.
Paying overtime, extra transportation costs, consumers are buying Pepsi instead of Coke.
So Brustein and his co-founder pitched Coke on an idea for an app they call Wonolo, which stands for Work Now Locally. The app allowed companies to post these extra unexpected jobs on Wonolo, where they could find vetted temps to do the work, just like, say, using TaskRabbit to find someone to clean your garage. Wonolo has since spun off from Coke, but haven't we always had temp workers in our economy? Has anything really changed? The answer is yes, and the reason is smartphones and GPS.
The ability to create a marketplace really depends on being able to match buyers and sellers.
Stuart Thornhill teaches entrepreneurial studies at the University of Michigan. Thanks to the smartphone most of us carry in our pocket, the ease of finding people ready to take on a little extra work has made it frighteningly easy for companies to offload jobs that would otherwise go to full-time staff.
If I were a labor organizer or on the workforce side, I'd find that a very concerning trend. If I were on the corporate employment side, I would see that as a cost-cutting measure.
If you can throw it in a bag, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Joe Franco. Franco works as a personal shopper for Instacart in Washington, D.C. Instacart is an app allowing people to order groceries, like the ones from this Whole Foods, and then have them delivered directly to their house. No fleet of trucks, no inventory, just software.
Hello.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I lied. They totally had the vitamin water. Coconut water. It was just
cool.
In front of the store.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Yep, have a great day.
As a senior at the University of Maryland, Franco says the flexibility Instacart provides is key.
So I take classes in the morning, and I'm done by around noontime. So on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'll typically work from 2 to 9 p.m.
Franco has worked for Instacart for about a year. He's paid by commission based on the quantity of groceries he picks up and how many deliveries he makes.
Typically, shoppers earn between $12 to $20 an hour. I've certainly had times where it's been more lucrative than that.
Still, at some point, many of us hope to have a real job, the kind covered by basic labor laws like overtime, unemployment insurance, Social Security, or even the occasional sick day. All benefits companies like Instacart, Uber, and Wonolo don't have to offer. The reason is that the companies say the people doing the work are technically independent contractors. Dean Baker is an economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research. He says the contractor loophole is creating a speedy race to the bottom.
So if people are willing to work 2 or 3 hours, you know, helping set up a display at a store, or mow someone's lawn or something like that, they're not doing that simply because you have this app on the web. They're doing that because of a larger set of policies that deprive them of alternatives.
By acting as middlemen in the market for temp work, Baker says these gig companies are able to skirt labor laws while putting pressure on other industries to do the same.
That's simply bad for the economy. We should have the same set of regulations everywhere, and it really doesn't matter if they order you over the web. It should be the same.
Baker says there's a key distinction between creating work and creating jobs. He points to Uber, which has 850 permanent employees and over 160,000 drivers. Jordan Metzer is the CEO of Washio, a mobile app for laundry washing. Maybe laws do need to change, he says, but people are going to use new technology, and he feels most people are savvy enough to seek out the work that suits them.
You know, a lot of our drivers are either music instructors or yoga teachers or students or professionals getting, you know, a new degree. And so it's an awesome opportunity to make additional capital.
According to the Department of Labor, the U.S. has around 2.8 million temp workers, which is a record. But those numbers only count the people employed by temp agencies and don't include a single person working in the gig economy. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
High on the list of things experts say will help cut healthcare costs is the not-so-simple act of sharing patient information. There is, to be sure, money to be made and customer satisfaction to be gained by making sure everybody knows what they need to know. Still, plenty of doctors say they aren't getting the information they need to help their patients. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein digs in to find out why.
We talk a lot about sharing medical information. For Dr. Neil Weinberg, it's more than numbers and files. It's essential to helping a person be well.
Not having immediate, accurate information in one chart can lead to complications for the patient. They could die. They could be pretty sick and end up back in the hospital with other problems.
That seriousness helps explain why doctors and hospitals around the country have begun to share information. Welcome to the dull roar of this server farm at the University of Pennsylvania. In all, the Penn Medical System uses 600 servers to exchange patient data. Chief Medical Information Officer Dr. Bill Hansen ticks off the list why Penn is only sharing as much as they do right now.
There's sort of a yin-yang of the desire to exchange information and protect information. There are also the politics of working with competitors.
We've been hearing about these issues, technical kinks, patient privacy, collaborating with competitors, for a while now. New data shows more than half the groups who are trying to better manage care through what are called accountable care organizations say they can't get timely patient data. And if those folks who have every economic incentive to get that information can't, there's a serious problem. University of Michigan professor Julia Adler-Milstein says figuring out how to cut through the challenges is key.
You need complete information to ensure that care is safe. You need complete information to ensure that care is effective. You need complete information to ensure that care is efficient and not wasteful.
Given the potential to improve health and lower spending, Adler-Milstein says we must learn which challenges are really blocking up the data. One problem, she says, is that electronic health record companies are making it difficult to connect with other health record companies.
We don't have good empirical data on that, but you just sort of can hear the chorus of complaints, you know, from anyone you talk to about how hard it is.
Adler-Milstein says one solution is to create a consumer's report of sorts for doctors and hospitals to show which electronic records companies make sharing easier. Dr. Ira Nash, an executive with North Shore LIJ Health System on Long Island, says it may be time to change the idea that doctors are in charge of all this stuff.
You want the patients in the middle. They're the consumer. We exist to serve their needs. Why should we own the data?
By its nature, much of medicine is guesswork. But when it comes to patient data, Michigan's Adler-Milstein wonders, why not take some of that guesswork away? I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
We went ahead and made $1 billion of $100 bills.
What could possibly go wrong? I ask you that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials barreled down 1.8% today. The Wawas were a given. That was too easy, by the way. 332 points ended at 17,662. The NASDAQ jolted down 1.2%, 82 points, closed at 4,859. The S&P 500 slumped 1.7% lower, 35 points, finished at 2,044. The sole ray of sunshine in the markets today, might as well start on an up note, fell on the clothing retail sector. Urban Outfitters zipped up 11% today on the back of some good earnings news. American Eagle Outfitters flew up more than 1%. Today is the day that the air started to come out of the dot-com bubble back in 2000, and most of the dot-coms that survived that crash were down again today. Amazon.com fizzled more than 2.3%. eBay auctioned off 2.6%. Yahoo yielded 0.7%. Google was not public back then. It's done all right since, but it didn't do so well today. Gap down 2.4% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National League of Cities Congressional City Conference, a gathering of municipal officials from around the country, wraps up. Something to go with your morning coffee. Krispy Kreme releases quarterly earnings. And the reality show Cops premiered March 11th, 1989. Arresting television. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The counterintuitive immigration fact of this Tuesday goes like this. For almost a decade, more people have been leaving the United States to go to Mexico than have been coming here. Whether that's voluntary or under some kind of duress, best guesses are that over the past 10 years, almost 500,000 Mexicans between 18 and 35 have returned home after living here in the States for 5 years or more. There is, of course, some reassimilating they have to do once they get there, but there are some opportunities, too. From Monterrey, Mexico, Andy Euler has that story.
Walk into one of the office buildings along Padre Mier, one of the main drags in downtown Monterrey, and you'll be hard-pressed to avoid hearing something like this.
Instead of departing from Houston, you want to depart from Monterrey, is that correct?
It's a call center. I pass nine as I walk down this particular street. Monterrey's a big city, Mexico's second largest, but it's still surprising to learn that there are more than 30 call centers here. Big American companies outsource to provide billing, technical, and sometimes even direct sales support. Juan Jose Cruz says his first job in Mexico was at Hispanic Teleservices. He spent most of his teenage years as an undocumented immigrant in Virginia. He's now 26 and decided to move back to Mexico about 5 years ago. He's from Guadalajara, but like many Mexicans that return home, he landed in Monterrey and started looking for a job.
It was just like, okay, I can speak English. No one speaks English down there, but I was completely wrong, you know.
It turned out there were lots of English speakers in Monterrey. And there was also lots of work in the call centers. Omar Solis also returned to go back to college. And he says he was pleasantly surprised with this particular job market, too.
It tends to pay more than any other typical Mexican job without having any sort of formal qualifications, any like diplomas or formal education. However, I think where there was a little bit of a difference there was the way I speak.
Bill Colton says that's exactly it. He's the president and co-founder of Global Telesourcing. They've had a call center in Monterrey for about 8 years. He says about 95% of the people they hire spent their formative years in the U.S., and you can tell when you're on the phone with them.
So the effective result is that our employees speak English not just well, but they speak it natively.
Colton says Mexicans that lived in the U.S. can get better service because they're essentially Americans. They understand the way American consumers think, therefore they're worth paying a little more. Juan Jose Cruz says there's not a lot of glory working in a call center. It was the pay that attracted him.
They were like, oh, you want to come work for us, you know, and it's like we offered this salary, and it was like, whoa, that's a big salary. For Mexico, they were like paying like 20,000 pesos.
That's 20,000 pesos a month, about 17,000 American dollars a year. That's significantly more than the 13,000 most Mexicans earn annually. Bill Colton doesn't see things changing for his business anytime soon. He says the biggest reason employees in Monterrey quit is not because they don't like the work or aren't happy with the salary. It's because they're going back to the States.
Based on what their life situation is and where they think they can best achieve their next objective, they're very comfortable picking up and moving across the border one way or the other because they're so truly bicultural and comfortable in both countries.
But for some, it's a little more complicated than that. Undocumented immigrants still can't legally work in the U.S. So as long as there's a market for these returnees in Monterey, there could be more Mexicans returning home for work than coming up to America. And as long as that's the case, the call center business in Mexico will continue to grow. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you like movies that involve bank heists or casino scenes or money falling from the sky somehow, say a helicopter or something, chances are you've admired the work of one of Hollywood's many prop companies. Sometimes, when the need arises, prop makers use real money in those scenes. But sometimes, that's just too expensive. So the prop companies make their own money, that is. But if they are, shall we say, too good at their jobs, yeah, things go downhill real, real fast. Zach Crockett explains.
Let me introduce you to a guy named Greg Bilson Jr. Greg runs a company called Independent Studio Services, or ISS.
My dad started the company literally in his garage in Culver City in 1976.
And one of his specialties is money.
Worldwide, there's maybe under 10 prop companies or graphic companies that make prop money.
Greg's provided prop money for pretty much every movie and television show you've seen in the past 40 years. Everything from 90210 to CSI to Indiana Jones and Rush Hour 2. And that's really where this story starts. In late 2000, the cast and crew of Rush Hour 2 gathered in Las Vegas to film the climax scene of the film. The premise of this movie was this. Two police officers, Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker, were chasing this super counterfeiter who was wanted for producing really high-grade counterfeit money.
We went ahead and made $1 billion of $100 bills, which is a tremendous amount of money. It was 14 pallet loads of $100 bills stacked 4 feet high, solid. In the scene, they were blowing it up in a casino.
And thousands of these fake bills would litter the ground.
How the hell you didn't tell me you had a bomb in your mouth?
I did.
No, you didn't.
The scene went well, but as these bills rained down,
many extras grabbed a few of these bills and kept them as souvenirs.
And some of them attempted to take them out to the Las Vegas Strip and spend this money.
Over the next couple of weeks, this money, these $100 bills, started turning up as counterfeit bills.
Needless to say, the federal authorities weren't too pleased about this. Secret Service agents swarmed the set.
They shut down the film, they shut down production, they confiscated all the existing money that was still out there, and then they came to visit ISS.
Greg Bilson and Independent Studio Services were essentially blamed for counterfeiting.
Most people would look at this bill and kind of laugh by itself. It is a very bad picture of Ben Franklin, who we name Franken. It says motion picture use only on 15 different places. It's in Dog We Trust. There are many, many things that are different than the real bill, but it still is not within the parameters of legal.
Bilson has to operate under the Counterfeit Detection Act of 1992. And what this law says is that bills have to be either 75% smaller or 150% larger than the size of a real bill.
And one color, one side.
As early as the inception of film, money's played a prominent role. Money!
Back in the day, it wasn't horribly regulated, so people would make pretty much anything they wanted. And then some time ago, Secret Service started regulating what you could and could not do, or it would be considered counterfeit.
And that puts Greg Bilson and other prop builders in Hollywood in a pretty tough spot. They have to skirt this thin line between these strict counterfeiting laws and producers' demands for incredibly realistic money. And sometimes these prop builders have trouble finding that sweet spot in the middle.
You know, movie producers and films and TV shows are kind of wanting us to break the law all the time. So we have to keep within those parameters or do it in a manner that is legal.
Like other prop masters, Bilson isn't trying to dupe the public. We try to make realistic props, he says. Sometimes we cross the line, but at the end of the day, that's my job. I'm Zach Crockett for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, which I'll preface by saying that I am clearly wasting my life in this job. According to an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that came out yesterday, just 14% of Americans, 14%, know who Janet Yellen is and have an opinion about her, good or bad. Almost three quarters of us don't know or aren't sure whether she is the most powerful person in the global economy. So I quit. No, wait. I'm not quitting. I'm kidding.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
See? I'm still here. All right. Today, the Dow plunged 1.8%, 332 points. The NASDAQ got crushed 1.2%, 82 points. The S&P 500 cratered 1.7%. That is 35 points. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.